On this day in this economy, money got more expensive. The media merger buzz continued, and I'm pretty sure Jay Powell tried to take my job. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 13th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. But I'll tell you what, this has been a day, honestly, where Fed Chair Jay Powell, wrapping up a two-day meeting on interest rates, has made me question what I do for a living.
Because monetary policy affects everyone.
Yes.
I want to start with a plain English summary of how the economy is doing.
Okay.
What my colleagues and I at the Federal Reserve are trying to do.
Right.
And why.
I thought that was my job, but by all means, sir, go ahead.
The main takeaway is that the economy is doing very well.
I was going to say that.
Most people who want to find jobs are finding them, and unemployment and inflation are low.
I've been saying that.
For the past few years, we've been gradually raising interest rates, and along the way, we've tried to explain the reasoning behind our decisions.
Again, my job, but don't let that stop you.
In particular, we think that gradually returning interest rates to a more normal level as the economy strengthens is the best way the Fed can help sustain an environment in which American households and businesses can thrive.
Which, at long last, gets to the point. The Fed did raise its short-term interest rates today 0.25 percentage point to put its target for what is known as the federal funds rate at 1.75% to 2%, as basically the entire economic universe knew it would. Two other things of note to tell you, one form, one function. Here's the form. Powell said starting in January, he is going to do a press conference after every Fed meeting instead of every other one, all in the service of making what used to be called Fed speak more intelligible. Again, my job. Also, the function, he was asked about trade policy and the economic impact of the contentiousness of it of late. First, he kind of sidestepped.
Congress has very specifically given authority over trade to the executive branch, so I wouldn't comment on any particular specific trade actions.
And then he kind of did answer.
Concerns about changes in trade policy are rising, I think it's fair to say. And also that you're beginning to hear reports of companies holding off on making investments and hiring people.
Net-net, though, jobs are good, inflation's good, and interest rates are probably going to go up two more times this year. All right, a turn now to the once and future state of corporate mergers and acquisitions in this economy, media division. Yesterday, as you know, AT&T was cleared to buy Time Warner for 85 billion simoleons, which has begat, apparently, a late afternoon but pretty much expected bid today from Comcast, $65 billion cash for 21st Century Fox, which Disney is already trying to buy. Coincidence? Oh, I think not. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at which would-be media dealmakers can take hope from the AT&T decision and which might ought to be more cautious.
The pace of mergers and acquisitions is already at record highs and now likely to keep chugging, says Matt Toole. He's director of deals intelligence at Thomson Reuters, which has tracked M&As for over 30 years.
The fact that this deal can go through without any conditions has kind of everyone in the media, telecom, technology space looking at potential areas of expansion or growth. You know, I think there are a lot of very busy investment bankers and lawyers over the past 24 hours.
Or put another way,
it's going to be a big year for all of the steakhouses that the investment bankers like.
Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan says media companies in a similar position to AT&T and Time Warner, reacting to tectonic shifts in their industry, can take hope from this decision. Also,
it's probably an encouraging decision for people in healthcare because there you have another industry that also is going through some changes and needs to go through some structural changes.
But he warns this doesn't mean any company can merge with anyone, especially in a deal between two direct competitors like T-Mobile and Sprint. In fact, the judge wrote in his opinion, the temptation by some to view this decision as being something more than a resolution of this specific case should be resisted by one and all. He even threw in an exclamation point. Donna Hittrich is with Columbia Business School.
It's a precedent-setting case, but I don't think it's as clear as if you do A, B, and C, everything's going to be great.
She says when it comes to M&A, especially in the media industry, this decision is a positive, but not a panacea. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Those who complain government policy moves too slowly, allow me to introduce you to the Seattle City Council. Last month, that council voted unanimously for what's often called a head tax, a set fee that bigger companies have to pay for each of their employees. Seattle's was meant to raise tens of millions of dollars to address homelessness and to help create more affordable housing in a city where both have become problems. And then yesterday, that same city council changed its mind. What's going on? Marketplace's Jed Kim is on that one.
This was not about Amazon, says Lisa Herbel, a Seattle city council member who pushed hard for the tax and then voted to repeal. Yeah, the company has brought tens of thousands of high-paying jobs, bringing a lot of economic growth.
That some have benefited from has created stark inequities and has increased homelessness.
The tax was an attempt to get about 600 large companies to contribute something to the growing problem.
We don't have a lot of options. We don't have an income tax.
Up against a well-funded repeal campaign, the city council ditched the tax. It's not clear whether Amazon helped fund the campaign, and the company would not comment, but Amazon increasingly defines the city, says Jacob Vigdor, who teaches public policy at the University of Washington.
This really is turning into a 21st century company town.
He says it's happened before when Boeing flooded the region with jobs during World War II. Housing kept up then. Affordable housing's tighter now, and that's something the 20 cities vying to become Amazon's second headquarters should consider. Boston, New York, you're crowded. Philadelphia or Pittsburgh.
These are cities that actually have room to grow. They have infrastructure that was built for a larger population than they have now, and it could actually be a really good thing for their economy.
Greg LeRoy tracks incentives for good jobs first. He says the timing of the repeal is significant.
This is a clear shot across the bow at every city waiting to hear from Amazon about HQ2 that we don't want to pay taxes.
Many cities are promising billions in incentives to Amazon. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Sideways was the trading buzzword of this Wednesday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Going to seem a little bit out of left field, but hang in there with me, would you? There are few combinations out there as successful in a business sense as a cup of coffee and a donut. It is, in fact, the predicate for the entire business model of one of the best-known companies in this economy, Dunkin' Donuts by name. That company, along with Baskin-Robbins, is owned by a company called Dunkin' Brands. Nigel Travis is the CEO, has been for almost 10 years now, and he is today's conversation from the corner office. Mr. Travis, it's good to talk to you, sir.
I'm delighted to be here.
That wasn't much of a thing for listeners to go on, but they will very quickly discover you're not originally from, shall we say, the Boston area, are you? How did a guy from East London wind up running this company?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot, Kai, and I have to say, for someone who's now 68, I've had a kind of an eventful career. I've had the opportunity to move from East London, where I was brought up in a very entrepreneurial family, moved through human resources for 20 years, and then finally ended up leading companies such as Blockbuster, Papa John's, Dunkin' Brands, and I've been a CEO now for 13 and a half years.
You spent time in Blockbuster, as you said, also Papa John's, but when you got this job running Dunkin' Brands in 2008-ish or so, am I right that you'd only been in a Dunkin' Donut shop like 2-3 times?
I hadn't been many times. In fact, back in, I think it was about 2007 when I was at Papa John's, we had a meeting in Florida, went into a Dunkin' store. It wasn't very good, and I said I wouldn't return. Well, I returned many times after that, and I'm kind of famed now for my store visits. And it's not only my store visits. I think they're more fearful of my 13-year-old son's store visits.
This is kind of a subjective question, or maybe the answer is subjective. I don't know. But it seems like Dunkin' Donuts now, it's almost cool and hip somehow.
Yeah, well, donuts are doing really well. I actually read the other day about potato donuts.
No.
Which I hasten to say I've never tried.
Yeah.
But the donut business is coming back pretty strongly. I think people want to give themselves something to reward themselves. Donuts perfect. And here's an interesting fact. If you buy one donut, if you buy a coffee, if you buy a sandwich, the biggest attachment, in other words, the extra product that goes with it, the biggest attachment is always a donut. So,
what extra do you have to buy with a donut?
Fascinating answer to that. The biggest attachment to a donut is another donut. So I mean, that is unusual. And when I first saw the numbers, I said, okay, go away and look at that again. That can't be right, but it's right.
Let me take you back to your HR roots here for a minute. One of the things you have said repeatedly in interviews and in statements you've made is that finding people to work in your shops is bar none the biggest problem that you have. Why do you suppose that is so?
Well, I think, Kai, it's a really interesting issue, and I think there's many reasons for it. I mean, without being able to support this statement, when I first came into the industry in, let's say it was about 1989 when I joined Burger King, 80% of Americans started their working career in a restaurant.
Wow.
That number now, I think, has dropped to 60. On top of that, I think the industry has had a little bit of a bad image, which we're trying to correct. But I think one of the issues is that because the economy is growing so fast, the demand for people is just outstripping supply, and we need to tackle the supply issue. And I think what that truly means is some kind of discussion about comprehensive immigration reform. So I think there are answers, but it's an answer which at certain times isn't always politically acceptable.
What do you make of the push to get higher wages for folks in the fast food industry and in your industry, broadly speaking?
Well, the first thing I'd say is our industry at various times has said no too easily to many things. I prefer to think that wages should be driven by the market. We've always been very open-minded to increasing the minimum wage either by state or by federal rates. But I think one thing that everyone has to recognize, at the end of the day, the best way to grow wages is to open stores. I mean, on an average year, we open between 300-400 net new stores with Dunkin' alone. And we do that by focusing on franchisee unit economics. And if we don't have good unit economics, we don't grow and we don't provide more jobs.
Yeah, but just to be clear, more stores and more jobs doesn't mean higher wages in those jobs.
No, but what I'm saying is it's no good just going for higher wages and ignoring the other side of the equation, which is unit economics.
Last question before I let you go, sir, and it's the put up or shut up question. How many times a week you figure you stop in at a Dunkin' shop or a Baskin Robbins?
I'd say probably on average about 8-9 times a week.
Really? Wow. Are you getting a donut every time?
No. I drink coffee every time. I love our sandwiches. Our sandwiches are great. My wife and I, whoever's up first, brew Dunkin' coffee at 5:30 every morning. So it's not just the number of times I go into the store. I touch our products probably on average 8-9 times a day. And makes me very happy.
Nigel Travis, the CEO of Dunkin' Brands. Mr. Travis, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kai.
The magic of radio means there is a whole bunch more of my interview with Nigel Travis yet unheard. We got into the very competitive nature of the coffee side of his business. Also, more into why young people today maybe aren't taking jobs in fast food. You can hear it on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up.
Over half of poor households pay more than half their income for rent. That leaves very little for everything else.
Healthcare, for one thing. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 0.4% today. That's 119 points, 25,201. NASDAQ unloaded a 10%, 8.7695. The S&P 500 slipped 0.4%, 11 points, 2775 there. As I noted, with maybe a little bit of peak, Fed Chair Jay Powell did some nice explaining today. Financial firms didn't care. JPMorgan Chase dipped 0.2%. Of course they cared. Bank of America did the same. Markets got their first real day to react to the AT&T Time Warner decision. AT&T shares erased more than 6% today. Time Warner accelerated nearly 2%. That's what typically happens in one of those merger buyout things. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from John in Austin, Texas, not too long ago, who says he and his wife think Marketplace is the most informative and creative radio program in America, which is nice to hear. If you agree with John, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to John and everybody who makes our work possible.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're going to do a real estate story now. It's actually not so much a real estate story as it is the financial crisis was 10 years ago. Yeah, but it's still with us story. There are places in this country where you can still see the crisis and the housing crash. Cities and towns where houses got stuck in a kind of foreclosure limbo and years later still haven't gotten out of it. They're just sitting there, deserted and deteriorating. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra went to Long Island, New York, where there are more homes stuck in that limbo than anywhere else in the country.
There's a town on Long Island called Roosevelt, named after the former president, Teddy, not FDR. It's about 45 minutes by train from Manhattan. Rappers Chuck D and Flava Flav are from here. So is Howard Stern. And so is Natalie Gary.
Kids are playing right here in the playground. But as you see, it's a nice neighborhood.
Gary, who's a financial advisor, is standing across the street from that playground in front of a two-story red brick house with a bright white fence. Pretty standard for Roosevelt.
You see, they keep up their house pretty nicely.
But just a few feet to the left,
they got to live next door to this.
This is a one-story house with gray shingles, a brick chimney, and plywood over the front window. Out front, there's a busted-up green SUV with a smashed headlight and its airbags deployed. There are dozens of abandoned houses like this in Roosevelt. There's one around the corner from Gary's house. And she says these aren't just an eyesore.
If you wanted to sell your home, you wouldn't get a good value if you got an abandoned home next door.
Those unwanted neighbors are known as zombie homes. They're a legacy of the financial crisis. In the early years of the 2000s, home values were soaring, and it was easy to get a mortgage. Terry DiDonato is a real estate agent on Long Island.
The banks were giving out loans to people that really weren't qualified for them.
Then home prices plummeted, and the economy collapsed. By 2009, more than 2 million people couldn't pay their mortgages, and foreclosure notices became as common in some places as junk mail. And here's where things get messy, so bear with me. Foreclosure is a complicated process, with legal proceedings and mountains of paperwork. Compound that by millions, and things get even more complicated. Not only were the courts backed up, but banks had also been sloppy with their record keeping. So the average foreclosure took a year, then two, and eventually three. Meanwhile, the housing market didn't recover. So some banks walked away. Foreclosure was more trouble than the houses were worth. And then there were the homeowners. Until a foreclosure is final, the borrower is responsible for the house. But a lot of people didn't know that.
I don't think people understood.
That's Terry DiDonato, the real estate agent, giving me a tour of Long Island. She says other people left because they were ashamed.
I think it was embarrassing because a lot of people are professionals and work very hard. They get embarrassed and they just say, all right, I'm out of here.
And that's how we got thousands of zombie homes stuck in foreclosure and abandoned. Nearly 50,000 by 2013. Clustered in states like New Jersey, Florida, and New York, where there are lots of protections for homeowners, so foreclosures take the longest. DiDonato and I are in Massapequa, a town about 10 miles from Roosevelt and on the water. There are beach clubs, docks, and big homes with manicured lawns. And there are zombie homes here, too. Some with telltale signs of squatters, like broken glass, empty liquor bottles, and abandoned shopping carts.
Nobody likes to have to live near this. So I've had people that will say, just keep going. I don't want to go in.
Hard words for a real estate agent to hear, especially in towns like Massapequa, where prices have recovered and other homes sell quickly. Local governments are fed up with zombie homes, too. Towns often have to pay to maintain them. Joseph Saladino is supervisor for the town of Oyster Bay, which includes Massapequa. He says the costs can be
sometimes as little as $500, sometimes as high as $3,000 to go on the property and clean up the vegetation, cut the lawn, cut back the trees.
And that's just one house, one time. So Oyster Bay passed a law in January requiring banks to pay the town $25,000 for maintenance on each of their zombie homes.
Thus far, we've seen 9 checks for $25,000 each. So the pool of resources is growing.
Other towns and states have passed laws to speed up the foreclosure process. And in recent years, the number of zombie homes has dropped by 70%, according to the foreclosure database Adam. But there are still about 14,000 zombie homes around the country. A constant reminder that even a decade later, the crisis still isn't over. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You can go out to Long Island with Marielle by way of the video she did on zombie homes. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel. We are Marketplace APN. There are more than 500,000 people in this country on any given day who are homeless. And with rising rents eating up a bigger share of people's incomes, plenty more are on the edge. And when you don't have a place to live, a whole lot of other things become problems as well, healthcare among them. Which is one reason the healthcare and insurance giant Kaiser Permanente is going to spend $200 million on affordable housing in the 8 states and District of Columbia where it operates. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on the Health Housing Connection.
Sydney Bond had been homeless for 5 years, living between shelters and friends' couches, when he got a call with good news. He'd gotten off a wait list to move into his own apartment.
I'm glad he didn't see me because I was like running down the street. I almost tripped on my face. I'm not gonna lie. You know, because I was so happy.
The call was from Healthcare for the Homeless. At its downtown Baltimore clinic, it provides medical care to homeless people and also connects them with what's called permanent supportive housing, a subsidized place to live, plus counseling and other social services. When Bond was on the street, he says his chronic asthma and high blood pressure would flare up. He also suffered from anxiety and depression.
Being homeless can put a strain on a person's mind because it was constantly worried about how I'm going to get out of here, what I'm going to do. I was constantly worried.
Now at 54, after more than 2 years in his own place.
You know, I keep track of my medication. I go to my doctor's appointments. You know, I see my psychiatrist. I see my therapist. So it helps me to take better care of myself.
And do you feel better?
Mm-hmm. A lot better.
More healthcare organizations are making that connection between housing and health. Hospitals subsidize apartments for the homeless in Chicago, Orlando, and Portland. Insurer United Healthcare has invested millions of dollars in affordable housing projects in Michigan and Wisconsin. Kevin Lindemood is CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless in Maryland. He says Kaiser's $200 million investment is a big step forward.
The real significance is you've got a major corporation saying it's within our business interests to recognize this relationship and increase the stock of affordable housing. We are confident that that kind of thinking will catch on.
Kaiser plans to focus not only on providing supportive housing for the homeless, but also on preventing the displacement of lower and middle income households. Nan Roman is president of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. She says rising rents have forced families to spend a larger share of their incomes on housing.
Over half of poor households pay more than half their income for rent. That leaves very little for everything else. People can't get healthy food, they can't access health care as readily, they're stressed, and all those result in poor health.
Just building more affordable units isn't enough, says Nathan Thomas, a peer recovery specialist at Healthcare for the Homeless.
The majority of the work, I believe, is keeping someone housed, because it's one thing to just take somebody, throw them in a box, and say, here's your box, thank you, have a nice day.
Many homeless people have mental health issues or disabilities that make it hard to live independently, he says. Thomas helps navigate those challenges.
Sometimes it's as simple as a text, how are you? You know, because a lot of times our clients don't have anybody but us.
Today he's talking with Sydney Bond about Bond's upcoming move to a nicer building.
There's a small shopping center.
Yep, shopping center. There's restaurants there.
The bus line is there. The subway's right there.
It's a long way from the crowded shelters and soup kitchens he left behind. Several studies have shown the economic payoff of supportive housing. A program in Los Angeles saved the county 20% on medical and social service costs for those who got housing. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one more from Fed Chair Jay Powell. Too good, as you will hear, not to mention.
You also asked about marijuana businesses.
It is actually a problem, as we have reported. Pot is illegal at a federal level, so federally chartered banks won't touch all those billions in pot-generated cash, which leaves banking regulators like the Fed. Well, here's Jay Powell one last time.
It puts the supervisor in a very, very difficult position. And, of course, this isn't our mandate. Has nothing to do with marijuana. So,
yeah. Whoa, man. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials down 0.4% today. NASDAQ down about 0.1%. S&P 500 also off 0.4%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.